Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. If you're in the Fresno area and you're watching the local news the past week, you may have seen a gentleman getting a very prestigious honor from the government of France. It was a ceremony at the San Joaquin College of Law, and our guest today is one of the founders of that college, but that never would have happened for him if he didn't make it home from World War II. 86-year-old John Loomis of Fresno, California, my guest today. I say of Fresno, California now, but about 70 years ago, it was Mauston, Wisconsin. What kind of town is that?
With a town of about 3,000 people in the south central part of the state.
And is that where you were on December 7th, 1941?
Yes. I first heard about it that Sunday afternoon. I was at a rehearsal of the senior class play, and one of our participants hadn't shown up, and our director was very upset with her for not being there. About half an hour late, she walked in and she said, "We are at war." I had a feeling in my pit of the stomach that this is it. I'm gonna have some changes in my life. We half-heartedly went ahead with the rehearsal, but then we gave up and all went home to listen to the radio.
I could see how that would stick with you. And when you did listen to the radio and you heard for yourself what had happened, I guess that probably solidified that initial feeling that you had.
Certainly did.
What were your plans at the time? Because you're halfway through your senior year in high school. I'm sure you had big ambitions.
Yes. I thought what I should do is try to find a way to be a part of it, but be a part of it with my whatever skills I had. So I applied for a number of competitive exams for entrance to West Point, Annapolis. And I did get, actually I had two alternate appointments to West Point, but there was one guy ahead of me each time.
So I'm sure when you look back now, all these years later, you probably say, my life would have taken a different course if I ended up at West Point.
It certainly would have, and as things turned out, I'm glad it went the way it did.
Well, I don't blame you. I've met your wife of 62 years. I've seen the pictures of your children on the wall. I know you have grandchildren, too, and none of that would have materialized if your story didn't work out exactly the way it did. Well, how did Uncle Sam get a hold of you? You didn't end up at a service academy.
I went to... In the fall, I went to Ripon College in Wisconsin. They had an ROTC program, infantry ROTC. So I joined that, and I thought that probably was the way to go for the time being. They encouraged us to join the Army Reserve, so I did. And the end of the following term of school, I was and everybody else there went off to basic training.
Yeah, you weren't in reserve for very long. They called it the Army Reserve, but it might as well have been the Army at that point.
Right. What it did do, I think, was let me finish a second term of college.
So you went off to basic training. Did you have an idea of what you wanted to do in the Army or what kind of action you were hoping to see?
I had no idea, and I didn't even think about that because I knew they would do the choosing for me.
And that they did. You ended up in the 95th Infantry Division, which is known now as the Iron Men of Metz, but you were a long way from Metz, France at this point. Tell me about what it was like to go through basic training, to be preparing for combat, not knowing what it was going to be like, but sharing that experience with a bunch of other young men probably in similar shoes.
Yes, a goodly number of the people in my training outfit were also Ripon College kids who I already knew before we went in, which was an advantage, of course. I felt as we finished training that I was probably in the best shape physically I had ever been in my life. But from there, actually, I went into the ASTP program. and went to the University of Pennsylvania to become an engineer. Two sessions there, and they terminated the program. And 300,000 of us across the country were parceled out, a great many of them, to the infantry.
And by this time, you're probably getting the idea, well, this is unavoidable. I thought maybe I'd have an appointment to a service academy. I'm in the Army Specialized Training Program and getting an education. Well, it time's up for that. They need me overseas.
Absolutely. Time was up. And I went to the 95th, which was then stationed in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and had some training with them, maneuvers in West Virginia. And those were mountain maneuvers, so the thought was, we're going to go to Italy. We were there on D-Day. And at the end of that day, we heard that we had troops on the ground in France.
So you're in West Virginia doing maneuvers when you hear about the D-Day landings.
That's right. And a month later, we were trundled up to Boston, put on a boat, and off we went to England.
Had you ever been on a ship like that before, or had any kind of similar experience? I'm sure not such a long journey on the seas, I'm sure.
No. Biggest thing I'd done was to take a ferry boat across Lake Michigan.
This was a little longer journey. How was that experience for you? Were you anxious? Were you excited? Were you scared? How would you describe your mindset at the time?
At that point, I was very excited, and I thoroughly enjoyed the trip across. Fortunately, we had been put aboard a few days early to do guard duty, and so I knew where not to be on the ship. I slept on deck every night. I stayed on deck almost all the time, rather than in the sardine can with the rest of the guys. And I've never seen more beautiful sky with no lights at all. Our ship was unescorted. We went first to the area of the Azores and then turned north and went around the north end of Ireland and into the Irish Sea and landed in Liverpool.
At that point, had you already been formed into the company that you would serve with? I understand you were a mortar gunner, right?
That's correct. Yes, I was. When I joined the 95th, I went right to a unit and assigned immediately to the mortar section.
So you had already built a bit of a connection and a bond and a trust with the guys that you would eventually serve with over there?
Absolutely. Had a real good bunch that... Actually, three of the five men in my mortar squad were ASTP. Only the sergeant and the first gunner had been with the outfit for some time before.
Some of our listeners may not be familiar with how a mortar worked at that time, and maybe they're familiar with more modern weaponry. I mean, this is, I guess, in terms of what we have today, this is a fairly primitive and basic weapon, but what can you share about how that operated, what maybe the challenges were of operating it, and how loud it was? Anything that you would like to paint that picture with?
The mortar was 60 millimeters in diameter, and it was just an iron tube about 3 feet long with legs on the front, and the back end sat on the ground. It had some things so that you could have it stabilized and could move it around and aim it. But for the most part, to aim it, except when you had plenty of time, it was a very difficult thing to get your shells to go anywhere you wanted them to go. Shells were about 8-10 inches long, and what we'd do is simply hold the tube in a fairly upright position, drop the shell in, and it would go plunk, and out it would go in a very high arc, and it would come down, hopefully, on the target we had aimed it for.
Now, who had to lug all that stuff around? Because it sounds like there's some heavy lifting to be done there.
That, heavy lifting because we had a team. There was the sergeant who would pick out the targets for us. The first gunner who would do the aiming, the second gunner, that was me, who would drop the shells in the tube, and two ammo bearers who would carry the shells. And that was about it. We never, or at least I did not have the experience of trying to use the mortar while we were on the move. Mine was always in fixed positions, which was for a period of several weeks where we moved from various places, but always got into a fixed position where we could set up our mortar, do the necessary things to find our targets and to get zeroed in on them.
And so you had had training in this. Once you got over there, did you feel like the training that you had had prepared you for what you eventually faced?
Oh, not particularly, but after a few days of tinkering with it, and we did a lot of learning very early on, and we knew what to do, but no, had practically no training in firing it and trying to spot and land on targets.
And I'm sure it fired perfectly every time, right?
Well, the shell always came out the other end, but there would be times when we'd get the report from our sergeant and say, where'd you guys send that? And, well, he said, I couldn't see it go down. Then he would say, try moving it over about 15 degrees and see if that will get it where we want it. So we'd try that, and pretty soon he'd spot it, and then we'd be able to move it into the target.
Certainly a work in progress, it sounds like, throughout that time. Well, we need to take a commercial break, but when we come back, we'll hear more from John Loomis about his experience as a mortar gunner with the 379th Infantry Regiment of the 95th Infantry Division in Europe in World War II. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We're visiting today with John Loomis. He's 86 years old. He's in Fresno, California. And if you've ever had anything to do with the San Joaquin College of Law, maybe you know that name. Maybe you were there on Friday a week ago when he accepted an award from the French government. He is a Chevalier in the Legion of Honor, according to the French. We'll find out what that means from him. It all traces back to his service in World War II with the 95th Infantry Division. He was in a mortar platoon, and we heard him explain kind of how the mortar worked, but I imagine that first taste of combat was something you never forget. Where were you, and what do you remember about first engaging the enemy?
We were on the east bank of the Moselle River, about 5 miles south of Metz in France. We had taken over positions which had been established by the 5th Infantry Division. They were pulled out to get a little R&R, and we took over their positions. So the first bit of combat took place as the 5th Division fellow was showing us the ropes, and we had thrown a few shells out, and we're standing there in the mortar position. And all of a sudden, he dove into the dugout. And then about three or four mortar shells landed right in the area. And we all had hit the ground, but not all that fast. A couple of the guys got a little shrapnel, and I was untouched. But at that point, we realized, hey, we're in it.
You say you were untouched, but how close did those shells come to where you were standing?
Well, two fellows got some shrapnel, and they were within 10 feet of me, so the shell was somewhere pretty close by.
So that sounds like a pretty big wake-up call to me that this is real, and I imagine your training had never involved live shells being fired in your vicinity.
That is true. They didn't want to waste them on just showing us what it was like.
And I imagine in some respects you were pleased to be in a mortar company as opposed to a rifle company because you were a little further away from the very front of the lines, but that tells you you're not so far away, huh?
I thought that was true, but my primary combat, I might as well have been a rifleman.
That's how close you were to the heavy action.
That's right.
So after that initial shelling, did your perspective change at all? Did that kind of alter your outlook? Did it shake your confidence? Did it produce more fear? How did you deal with that experience?
Got used to it, I would say. Quite nervous to begin with. I recall about the second night we were there, my buddy and I were standing guard, and off went a German machine gun in the draw uphill from us. And so we fell to the ground, and we just, what's going on? And so we just kept wide awake for the rest of the night, and that was it. And after that, things sort of calmed down and got kind of used to stuff like that.
Was there anything that kind of helped you maintain that mindset? Maybe, you know, friendship with other soldiers, letters from home and prayers, anything like that?
I think it was mostly just being there with buddies and working out the problems as they came along.
Well, you mentioned the city of Metz, France, which is a city you'd probably never heard of before the war, but probably one that you haven't forgotten since the war. The nickname, the Iron Men of Metz, implies the tenacity and the persistence that the soldiers you served with employed in resisting the Germans there. Tell us, give us an overview of what happened at Metz and why your division was so crucial.
We were part of the 20th Corps in the 3rd Army. We had the 5th Division to our right, and they were just south of Metz, and we had the 90th Division on our left, and they were north of Metz. We were directly west of Metz. And the 5th and the 9th were making a pincer movement around the city, and we were making the direct frontal attack on the city. And we had to pass through a line of forts and fortifications that have been in place there for centuries, and have been the sites of many battles in years gone by.
Which is something that General Patton reflected on frequently from what I've read, that the history of all those areas, and you're serving in Patton's 3rd Army. Did you guys have a certain opinion of Patton? I've heard a lot of different perspectives on him, and old blood and guts was often our blood, his guts. Did you hear any of that?
Absolutely. I was not a fan of Patton's. He talked about, we are going to bloody this new division. That was speaking about us. We didn't appreciate that kind of an approach. So, and he also told us to do some things which I thought were violations of the Geneva Convention. We'll just leave it at that. And
so that's obviously something that you morally objected to and didn't do yourself, it sounds like.
That's correct. I was put in a dilemma at one particular time, whether to shoot them or to take them as prisoners.
And what did you do?
I took them as prisoners.
Did you catch any flack for that?
No. I don't think anybody else knew it.
Well, that sounds like a pretty good story. What more can you share about where you were and how that circumstance arose?
We had been in what I would call the primary action that I was in, and we had gone through the worst part of it. We had pretty much put a whole bunch of machine gun emplacements out of business, and we're beginning to move on in kind of a scattered way. And I happened to notice a little white flag waving over a foxhole. So I wandered over there, and out came 7 Germans.
Now, I've heard a lot of stories where a white flag didn't always mean a white flag. Were you concerned at all that maybe this was a trick or a trap?
Absolutely, and I was waiting for them, and they came out with hands up. And I told them to halt. They halted. And I quickly thought, what should I do now? And so I told them, waved my arm and told them to go toward our rear, which then they started walking toward our rear.
Now, are you all alone at this time?
Basically, yes. So I watched them go, and they went quite a distance. And then after they'd gone out of a good gunshot range, they turned and went to, instead of straight ahead, they took a left turn and went toward the big fort that was about a quarter of a mile off to in that direction.
So what was the implication of that?
That I would have to deal with them again. So that was all. The other thing I didn't do, I wasn't supposed to take prisoners. That was one. And the other problem I had was that I was not to return toward the rear for any reason. The attack must always go forward per General Patton. I wouldn't have been criticized for taking them back, but I felt I should just keep on going and reach the objective that we had been assigned to get. So I partly followed his instructions, but not entirely.
What was the divergence from those plans?
Taking the prisoners was the one divergence, and then I followed his order, which was to continue forward rather than go to the rear.
So you did keep going forward. And I imagine in doing so, while you were not wounded, you probably witnessed a lot of your fellow soldiers and even mortar men being hit?
I didn't witness them being hit. I heard one being hit. My good buddy, whose head was right at my feet, he got the machine gun tracers went right by my head and hit him.
That sounds like a horrific experience. What it probably happened very fast, and how did you realize what had happened? And it probably takes you a second to figure out that you didn't get hit, huh?
We had been spotted by the Germans. It was dark, early morning, and we suddenly had flares opening up overhead and lighting up the place. At that point, then the machine guns opened up from the other side, and we all hit the ground, and it was within a second or third burst that came right past my head and went by, and I heard it thunk, and I heard the fellow behind me go, So I called to him, and no response, so I knew he was hit.
Was that harder for you to process and deal with than things you had seen to that point?
Didn't have time to process. The only thing I could think of to do was to get going and try to get rid of those machine guns.
And is it possible, when you're in a situation like that, to avoid thinking, that could be me, that's going to be me? What if it happens to him, I'm in the same position.
My thought was, I've got to get them before they get me. No, I was very aware that I was in mortal danger.
So this is going on for a while as the divisions that you described are trying to liberate Metz, and you eventually did. Is that something where you had awareness of the progress of that, and you knew how close you were getting to pushing them out of Metz?
Not after that point, because we were, the group I was with moved on to a hill overlooking the city, and at that point we had contact with the rear only by radio for 5 days, and we were supplied by air for 5 days.
When did you get the sense that there's some kind of victory that has been achieved here, and that the task that you set out to do that Patton was so demanding about was actually fulfilled?
Well, it was at the end of the fifth day, as we were sitting on the hill, our 3rd Battalion finally got through to us and took up positions on our left. And we also were told that the 1st Battalion on our right had pulled up on our right side. And the next morning, we moved down into the suburban area on the west bank of the river, and we knew that things were really closing in on Metz pretty fast.
And I know recent events have certainly hit home how much the efforts of you and your fellow soldiers are appreciated back in France. I want to talk more about that, but also about what took you off the lines of the 95th Infantry Division. We need to take another break, but when we come back, more with John Loomis, 86 years old, of Fresno, California. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. The time is moving by on today's program as we visit with John Loomis of Fresno, California. He served with the 95th Infantry Division, the Iron Men of Metz in World War II. He's since been back to Metz, France, and just over a week ago, he was honored by the French government. He is now a Chevalier in the Legion of Honor. He's going to tell us what that means in a little while. But first, let's go back to 1944, and his division, along with two others, are trying to drive the Germans out of Metz, France. You described pretty much the end of that battle as it was coming to a close, and you were realizing that the Germans were being driven out. And then you ended up in a personal situation where you were being driven out of your company. Tell us what happened with your feet and how you ended up getting taken off the lines.
Along about the fifth day, I and the buddy who were together went down to the village below us and tried to find something to eat.
The K rations weren't cutting it?
Well, we didn't have enough because we were being supplied by air and the airdrops were quite minimal. Ammunition came first, food second, and it was K rations that we did get. Anyway, the when I got back up to the hill and got in the hole for the night, my feet began to hurt like the devil, and finally I just crawled out of my hole, took off my overshoes and then my shoes, and found that my feet were swollen, put the overshoes back on, and just lay out on the side in misery from the pain. After when morning arrived, the whole company moved out. My buddies helped me down the hill, and I was then a jeep came along and took me to a battalion aid station in a German barracks. And after some time there, I was transported to a field hospital, spent the night there. The next day, they put me on an airplane along with a bunch of other casualties and sent me to England.
Now, this was a result of the conditions that you were fighting in, and maybe we didn't cover that all that much, but you'd been sleeping outdoors in the elements in a foxhole for a while, huh?
That's true, and it rained almost every day, and one night it snowed, and it was cold all the time. So my feet just plain, the circulation just plain shut down. And it had been shut down for probably a couple of days when I had gone down the hill to liberate some food. And the result was that once some blood started getting back in there, they just swelled and they were in shape, bad shape.
Were you concerned that you might lose your feet?
I never really thought about that, but after I was almost a week in hospital in England, the doctor, major, who always looked like he had just was ready to go to bed, he looked so worn out, would come in and chat with me. And about the sixth or seventh day when he came in, he said, "Well, looks as though we're not going to have to take off your feet after all." And I said to myself, "I didn't know they were even thinking of such a thing." And so they didn't take them off. I lost a bit of toe and have some problems with joints and so forth in one foot. But they came back really pretty well.
Well, and I imagine there you may have thought at the time that even though it was probably hard to leave your buddies back where they were, that maybe this saved your life to be taken off the lines at that point?
Yes, I did think that, although I was beginning to think at that time that I had been so lucky so far that maybe my luck was going to hold.
Well, that's a good point. You had dodged some sticky situations to that point. How long was that recovery process? And you just described there are still some lingering effects of this that you've been living with for close to 70 years, but how long was it before you could get up and walk again and made me think you could contribute again?
Well, it was November the 20th when I could not walk. And I did not get a pair of shoes until my 21st birthday, April 25th of 1945. About 6 months, 5-6 months.
That must have been a very difficult situation. Was there something that kind of helped you stay focused and kept you motivated to get back to that point?
At that point, I was having the best time that I ever had in the Army. The hospital in Auburn was well supplied with things to entertain. Had a music listening room. I took lessons. I took classes at Placer Junior College. Teachers came out to give classes. I got my AA degree from Placer Junior while I was there, and enjoyed the fellows I was with, because there were some of the fellows I had been with in combat, and it was good to be able to review what we had all been through with other guys.
And there's another reason that that hospital in Auburn, California holds a very special place in your heart. It was during this time that you met someone special?
No, not exactly then. Well, I could tell you someone special, which was another soldier. That's not what you're aiming for.
Well, you can tell us that story too. And then when you took a trip from Auburn down to Stanford, you can tell us the rest of it. But feel free, share that story too.
Just very quickly, I met a chap who was wheeling himself around in a wheelchair in a rather raucous fashion. And I sort of said, hey, he looks interesting. So we started chatting. And I found that he had been hit by a machine gun bullet about 5 feet from me as we were both heading for the woods as fast as we could. He was subsequently captured by the Germans, taken to Saarbrücken, where he was interrogated, and then brought back to Metz and put in a hospital. And when our forces finally took Metz, the Germans had left the wounded prisoners behind. They didn't want to have to take care of them. And so he ended up in the same hospital I did, and I told him, Robin, you should write a book about your experiences. And he did, subsequently.
Do you know the title of the book?
The book is called Resurrection. The author is Robin Gujdusek, G-U-J-D-U-S-E-K. And I lost track of him until I was in New York early in the night, about 1992 or so. And I was in a restaurant that had lots of books, shelves. And there was a book, Hemingway's Paris, Robert Gujdusek. And I said, that has to be. And I pulled the book off the shelf and discovered that he was at this point teaching English at Cal State San Francisco. So I got on the telephone, and we've had many contacts after that. He's now deceased. But in the process of those contacts, he wrote the book I mentioned and tells a very fascinating story. he probably had every experience a soldier could have in his 3 days of combat. He had come to us as a replacement. 3 days of combat and 5 days of as a POW. Well, actually not five. It wasn't quite that many because he lay in the shell hole for about 3 days before he finally crawled out and got captured.
Well, I'll put a link to that book on our website for people that are interested. And it strikes me that in what you guys did in finishing off the liberation of Metz while he was a prisoner there in a hospital, you may have saved his life because he never ended up in a POW camp and ended up getting home and recuperating.
That's right. I think, in fact, we both thought that probably if he had been carted off that they would have amputated his feet. His feet were far worse than mine. And his feet were far worse than the machine gun shell that went through and broke his lower leg.
Well, that is a small world connection that you were able to make with him, and I'm always fascinated by those stories. And there's another part of your story I want to get to, including that other special someone, but that will bring us to the final chapter of the program today. So we'll go ahead and take a break. We'll talk about that, the rest of John Loomis's experiences during World War II, what he remembers about the end of that, and some of the things that he's done since. We'll cover as much ground as we can when we come back. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We continue our visit with John Loomis. He's 86 years old. He lives in Fresno, California. He's had a long career here in the San Joaquin Valley, originally from Wisconsin. He served in the 95th Infantry Division in World War II. You've heard him talk about that. You've heard him talk about the trench foot that took him off the lines, ended him up in a hospital in Auburn, California, where he was recuperating. And I guess when you were feeling up to it, you heard about some university not too far away that you thought you might want to use the GI Bill and go to?
Yes. Actually, I was taken there by a friend. I had a friend from home who was an orderly at Letterman Hospital in San Francisco. So after I got a pair of shoes, I went down to visit Bill Newkirk. And Bill and his wife took me in their car down the peninsula, lunch at Dinah's. They found a nice whack to be my date. And after lunch, we went to the Stanford campus and walked around. I decided that was where I wanted to go to school. So a couple of months later, when I was discharged, at that point I was in Fort Custer, Michigan, I immediately started putting together the stuff I needed to apply to Stanford. Didn't get the word, but I went out anyway and walked in the front door and asked if I could be enrolled. And they thought about it and said, well, we'll do it provisionally and see if what you tell us about yourself will pan out and prove your eligibility. Apparently it did, because I was never asked about it again. But after I had gone through three terms at Stanford, I stayed for summer school. And during that time, I met a lovely young lady who, within 6 weeks, I was engaged to marry, Sue Henderson from Fresno, California. And about a year later, approximately, we were married, and joined me for my last 2 years of law school.
Now, I imagine when you were in that foxhole in Metz, France, with your feet freezing and hurting and not knowing when the next machine gun bullet was going to fly by, you probably never sat there and thought, I'm going to go to Stanford University, marry a beautiful lady, have children and grandchildren, and be a lawyer and found a law school in Fresno, California. That probably would have seemed a little hard to believe at that point, huh?
Absolutely. I had no thoughts about what the future was going to bring other than hoping that there would be a future.
So you had the privilege of going to law school up there, but after you had established your career here in the San Joaquin Valley about 40 years ago or so, someone had an idea that the Valley needs a law school of its own?
Yes, that's right. approximately 40 years ago, I had a telephone call from Judge Dan Iman, who said, I want to establish a proper law school in this community, and I'd like you to give me a hand on it. Will you come to a meeting? And I said, well, Dan, I'm pretty busy. I don't know whether I can do it. He said, well, you just come and listen and see what you think. I listened, and I was hooked. And so Dan, Ollie Wanger, that's Judge Wanger, and I put it together.
And now, 42 years later, it's going strong. What gives you the most pride when you think about what San Joaquin College of Law represents today and all the people who have earned their degrees there?
The people who've gone there and earned their degrees and are out there practicing and being pillars of this community. It's great to know that I've helped them become what they are.
So when you got word recently, and you, in the years since the war, you've been back to Metz, France, you've even found the location of your last foxhole there, which I know is very meaningful, and feel free to share about that. But when you got the word that the French government was going to award you the privilege of being a Chevalier in the Legion of Honor, there was nowhere you'd rather do it than San Joaquin College of Law.
That's correct. Yes, I got a letter from the French ambassador, which at first of all, I thought that this might be some sort of a joke. I don't understand this. But I followed up, and it was true. And so I talked with our dean, Jan Pearson, and told her I thought that the school might be a good place to do this. She agreed. Actually, that was where it was going to be held. It was actually held in the Clovis Veterans Memorial Center, right next to the campus. A lovely facility for such an event as that.
Absolutely, and it is really literally a stone's throw from the campus on the same corner of the street there on 5th and Hughes in Clovis, and kudos to the Clovis Veterans Memorial District for all they do for veterans around here. I want to know, what was that ceremony like? Because when you were in Metz, France, you were a 20-year-old kid from Mauston, Wisconsin. A lot has changed in the years since, and here you are, 86 years old, and the French government wants to thank you for something you did a lifetime ago. What did that mean to you?
I felt, very honored, of course, and appreciative. And I was glad to be recognized, but I felt that the recognition was not for me, but really for my buddies. It belonged to us all, and I just wished that they were there to share it with me. I guess that's about it.
When you get an honor like that, I guess it forces you to reflect, and you just talked about your buddies. When you look back at everything that you've done with your life and the lives that have been touched because of what you've done and everything we've just talked about is evidence of that, do you think about the guys that didn't come home, what their lives would have been like? Or do you think that what they did enabled you to have the life that you've had? How would you put that in perspective?
I think mostly about what they might have done. There were some real fine people who didn't come back.
What was it like for you when you were back there in Metz? I know it's been a few years now, but to see with all the time past how that area of the world has revived and stepped forward in large part because of what you and the guys like you did, and to go back and stand in the very same spot where the German bullets were flying at you all those years ago.
Well, I've been back there twice. The first time, the city looked rather dingy. They were still doing a lot of recovering. The second time was the 50th anniversary. The city looked just wonderful. They were all spiffed up for the celebration, and the people were just marvelous in the way they treated us. And we had just a great time talking with the people of the city, and the being feted by them, dinners, lunches, ceremonies. Yes, it was that was a marvelous experience, and it made one feel, yes, what we did was really worthwhile for these people, and we are glad that they appreciated it.
Absolutely, and it's good to know that people appreciate it here too. I know sometimes it doesn't always feel that way, and you wonder if people even know what World War II was these days. Is there anything in closing that you think we ought to know, those of us who weren't born yet, who weren't alive, who are trying to understand just what happened and why you all did what you did? Is there any way that you would try to frame that for us so we understand the significance of what you and guys like you did all those years ago?
Perhaps to say that we realized that what we were doing was something that really had to be done. And we hoped that in doing it, one, that we would survive, two, that we would succeed, and that three, the world would be a better place for our efforts.
Well, I think that is certainly the case. Mr. Loomis, thank you for serving our country, and thank you for sharing some of that with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, the pleasure has been all mine, and I feel that way every week on this program. What a privilege it is to sit face-to-face with people who put their lives on the line for the sake of our freedom, to hear about the horrific ordeals they endured, and also, as we're reminded powerfully again this week, what they've done with their lives since then. Before we close the show this week, I'd like to reflect on another veteran whose impact on the San Joaquin Valley is impossible to miss. Gus Zernial passed away Thursday at the age of 87. He was an absolute giant of a man in every way, an all-star on the diamond, in the broadcast booth, and in life. I considered his friendship and encouragement a major blessing, and I felt privileged to welcome him as one of the first veterans I ever interviewed here on Hometown Heroes. I dug up that interview from 2007 and thought I'd share just a little bit of it with you today. Long before he slugged his way to the nickname Ozark Ike, Gus was a sailor just trying to survive World War II, and he shared the story of a deal he made with the Almighty.
I was overseas, and of course on Sunday morning we'd have chapel, and I remember I knew what I was in, but I wasn't afraid of the war. I was never afraid of anything, really. But I went to chapel one day, and I said, I respected my family very, very much. And so I went into chapel, and I was saying, I was sort of talking to the Lord, not praying. And I said, Lord, if you'll just get me through this conflict we're in, through the war, and let me play 10 years in the big leagues, and live to be 70. I said, I'll speak of you. I'll do whatever it takes to shine a light the rest of my life. Well, obviously what happened, I'm here. The war didn't get me. And I played 11 years in the big leagues, a little more than 11. And so I made my 10 years. And I passed that 70 mark up a long time ago. I'm 84 years old. So he has answered my prayers. And I mentioned that, I think, in the book that here I'm still going.
Yes, Gus wrote a terrific book about his life, which is even more of a treasure now. And that story is in it with some other great stories. I have a link for you on our website, kmjnow.com. Remember, you can always find more info on the program there and also on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We're out of time for today, but please join us again next week for another edition of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.